This is Spring, 1998, Mr. Leslie Dreyer by Sally Brown.
For his allergies, and he was in business, and he subsequently, for various reasons, he used to walk a lot, and one day I don't want to go into too many of these details, but he bought the Maplewood during World War II when it was closed. I have all this sort of historical reconstruction, not really personal. Mm-hmm. History. I first was a very young child, started going to Maplewood in the late 40s and kept going until the early 60s when it burned down. And that's essentially the beginning. My parents had a little, what they called a cottage. There were lots of cottages around the hotel. They were actually very big houses, but they were referred to as cottages. And the hotel was a very independent kind of place. They made their own, did all their own baking, including the bread. Mm-hmm. They did their own, they had a butcher shop. Mm-hmm. They had an ice plant, and before that, an ice house. Mm-hmm. They stored ice from Forest Lake. Mm-hmm. Much of the milk, I just saw Ronnie Lister yesterday down at the Chevrolet dealership. We were talking about his grandfather selling milk to my grandfather. Mm-hmm. Much of the dairy came from right here at
the farm.
At Mid-Acre Farm. Mm-hmm.
I heard some of the details about how your father did buy the hotel. Would you talk about that?
You mean about religion and that sort of thing? Yeah, well, supposedly, this is my grandfather.
Okay.
He liked to take walks, and for him in those days, and it always amazed me that someone who immigrated from Eastern Europe and had absolutely no knowledge of English, or no knowledge of, he was never educated in English, he never could really write very well. He was very smart. He could read. He had a steel company, and he could build enormous buildings and figure out how to do things. But he was not really extremely literate. And for him to come from the Lower East Side to New Hampshire for his allergies, and then decide to go into business in this remote part of the country, always astounded me, and I gave him a great deal of credit for that. But one day he was taking a walk and passed the golf course and saw a sign that said, "No Jews or dogs allowed beyond this point." And that's when he bought it. At the time, he owned a number of other hotels, so this was just one more. It wasn't, I guess, that big a deal. He also, I think, assembled quite a bit of the property that still is in our family around the hotel. I think it used to be lots of different pieces. I think little by little, he put much of it together. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And over the years, it was run, it had all different kinds of management over the years, because he wasn't, after a while, he didn't operate. He used to keep selling it to different people who would only seemed to own it for a year or so and then give it back, because I don't think it was a big money maker. The season was only 10 weeks long.
Yeah.
And little by little, people started coming more for the weekends, and it became a car trip, and when the roads improved, instead of a big summer vacation with you bring a servant or something like that really stopped. And all those certain things that today we would find extremely elegant remained, they died, there was less and less of that.
What are the years for that?
His dates, I guess, would be 1943 to 1962, or so, until it burned down. At the time it burned down, it was one of those eras when the hotel was actually in the hands of another party. Mm-hmm. But my family would come up every summer, because I was never sure exactly of the financial arrangements. I was just a teenager then. And somehow or other, there were all these, some kind of, these partnerships going on. Mm-hmm. They were, I guess, fairly complex. Mm-hmm. But the way the insurance worked and everything, when it burned down completely, he was paid off and it completely left our hands. That's when the hotel went finally into the hands of another buyer, mm-hmm. since 1943. Some of the owners were very colorful. Some mm-hmm. of them were, there was a funny story about I have a cousin who...
Excuse me.
Yeah, the Maplewood, by the way, was a very kind of jumping place. They had waitresses from college, all college kids. And there was they had a great softball team, and they had activity. I mean, it was a wonderful place to work, and the guests were very nice to the employees. And they would do things like at night, there was a nightclub, and the staff was able to sit on the porch outside the nightclub and look in. They had these big windows in this field. And the guests would always hand drinks out to the employees and that sort of thing. I had a cousin who worked as a dishwasher. He had very bad allergies, He worked as a dishwasher. He was older than I was. He was a dishwasher at the hotel. One summer, they had very serious gambling at the hotel. This was one of the new operators, and that was his thing. My understanding is that he had to be expelled. This owner finally did, because actually it was so bad that the guests were being threatened with guns for their gambling debts. But it was a serious type of gambling, not like I remember when there was gambling when I was a teenager. Matt Washington had roulette wheels and things like that all over the place, slot machines. But that was kind of low key. This was a serious gambling operation. Mm-hmm. There was a resident hooker in the hotel that summer, and she liked my cousin Ronald, and they became sweethearts. But my grandmother lived in the hotel, and she found out about it. She was furious. She didn't approve of that one bit. And at the same time, my grandfather owned the Twin Mountain House in Twin Mountain.
Oh, yeah.
At the corner of 302 and Route 3.
Right.
And the Twin Mountain House, I think you had to be 80 years old in order to rent a room there. It was the most, it was really like a backward, not backwards, but an old-timey place. Yeah. You know, the entertainment was a harvest. They had the sport there. Well, the Maplewood people were playing 36 holes of golf a day up there. They had a shuffleboard court. That was about it.
Maple was a party place.
Yeah, it was great. But my cousin Ronald, after my grandmother found out about his relationship with this hooker, he said he was exiled to Twin Mountain. He had no car or anything. He had to spend the rest of the summer at Twin Mountain all by himself. It was a sad disaster.
Well, the cottages are still there, right? The three cottages that are across from the Maplewood?
But those didn't all belong to the hotel. There's one that did belong to the person who owned it before my grandfather, Mr. Dalton, where I think maybe Don Ferringo.
Yes, that's right.
I guess the first one. Mm-hmm. The second one, the next one belonged to Fred Whitcomb, who was the son was eventually fire chief in Littleton, but who Fred Whitcomb Sr. was a fire warden and a postmaster, because there was a post office in the hotel, and he was the caretaker of the hotel. And he raised five sons in that house.
Gary would be one.
Gary lived there, yeah. He was the oldest. You know Gary?
Gary's on the list, sure.
He'd be good.
Yeah.
The next one was part of the hotel. It was called Cottage 14. In fact, my family lived there for one or two summers, and some relatives of mine lived there for another 20 years. The next one belonged to Mr. Franzine, who owned the caddy camp.
Yeah.
He didn't own the caddy camp. He was the main sponsor.
For the kids' camp.
And he was that. He is certainly a major story and a wonderful person to find out about. Mr. Franzine.
The station, that beautiful old building, is where the guests were dropped off, is that right?
Probably, but that'd be way before my time, because my grandfather showed me that in the woods one day, and I had lived around there for years, and I couldn't believe it, because I was only here in the summers.
Yeah.
So there, it was full of leaves. I'd never seen it. It was falling down in 1955, I guess it was falling down, yes.
And it's really falling down now. Yeah. It's too bad. So what was it like for you, being up here, and how many summers were you here?
I was here from 1950 to 1948 to 1962, something like that. Towards the latter part of the 50s, I guess I started working at the hotel, which was interesting and exciting. So it was an interesting schedule because people, besides the crew in the restaurant, the dining room, and who were amazing, because we had a maitre d' who worked here, and there was a sister hotel in Florida, the Mayflower, so many of the same staff worked in both hotels, obviously not the college kids. But the maitre d' was able to train, they'd take these kids in about a week, he had them trained, so the service was meticulous. If a woman took out a cigarette, a waiter was there to light it for her immediately. She didn't have to ask or anything like that. These kids were polishing, the silverware was constantly being polished. They had wonderful dishes to line the, you know, when you sat down, there were very nice dishes in front of you, and then the liner would be removed.
Right.
It was very, you know, fine service.
Mm-hmm.
On every Saturday and Wednesday night, my father would wear a tuxedo and the women wore long dresses. That was just something that was automatically done. They had fabulous cocktail parties with ice sculptures and things like that. I think probably that's one reason why the place never made money. It was very lavish. The food was terrific. The rooms weren't so hot. I mean, the rooms had rolling floors, and on a summer night on the top floor, it could be sweltering up there.
Mm-hmm.
But the food, the entertainment, and the golf, they were wonderful, and people liked that.
Yeah.
And people worked very hard. The season was 10 weeks, and you didn't get a day off.
Yeah.
You just worked right through the
yeah.
whole time.
Yeah.
My shift, when I worked on the front desk, my shift used to be 8 to 12 in the morning, and then 6 to 12 at night.
Mm-hmm.
And then the next day, I'd work from 12 noon to 6 p.m.
Mm-hmm.
It was a split shift.
Right.
But it could be very difficult, especially if you were dating, because you'd go out at night, you'd be going out at midnight,
yeah.
you know, first starting to get rolling.
And there was plenty to date, wasn't there?
Yeah, there were a lot of nice, and there was some great looking waitresses, nice Zoom. I didn't ever, I guess the busboys looked pretty good, too. Young bellmen, and some of them were, you know, very bright people, and many of them went on to become,
yeah.
And I remember that we had a roll boy there that got the job, because he was a friend of my parents, and he's now a urologist in West Palm Beach.
Yeah.
I see him sometimes.
Yeah.
He talks about the summers of the Maple Leaf.
Yeah.
Great fondness.
You were at the front desk, right?
Yeah.
That was...
But I also did, you know, when I was younger, I worked at the pool, and I was a caddy. I wasn't a caddy full-time, but sometimes they'd have some very busy weekends when there'd be shortages of caddies, and they would retire just about anybody. And that was, I thought it was great money, because I could make it a day. I could make maybe $3 or $5. More than I'd ever see at the pool.
Mm-hmm.
And even the season, I mean, college people would work at the front desk for the whole summer for $200. But they would have their room and board pretty much taken
right.
care of. They lived
right.
in dormitories.
Right.
They ate in what they called the zoo, which was
mm-hmm.
where the food was pretty awful there, actually. And
where did they stay?
In the back of the hotel, the hotel made a kind of a U. But only two sides of the U were for guests, and one side was for the staff.
Oh, yeah, I see.
And then the upper echelon would stay in various cottages. For instance, there was a big cottage right on the golf course called, I forget the name of that cottage, and the band stayed there.
Mm-hmm.
Right up from that, there was another little place called the Canteen, where everybody used to go eat. Those buildings aren't there anymore.
It's your own community.
Well, the garage is still there. If you go down Maple Hill Road, you see on the right, there's a garage that had gas pumps.
Yeah,
and they
I do.
People's cars.
I know that. Yeah.
And the place was full of cars. Everybody
yeah.
drove because
right.
there were just cars all over the place.
Yeah. Damus Champagne, I think, worked there. I think so. He was a mechanic.
Well, the house that was the boiler room was right across from the garage. That's where they heated the water and the steam.
Mm. It's amazing, the systems and the work. A lot of
work. And Mr. Whitcomb, who lived in that house I told you about, he had it all under his thumb. I mean, he really knew what everything was going on. And his sons, his older sons especially, they knew also because they started working with him. And I mentioned, they're all very handy fellows, and they could do anything.
Mm.
I was admired and respected them for that.
Yeah.
They're so capable.
Yeah.
And I think a lot of it came from that era.
Yeah.
Your dad, the environment.
When you came up for this... Was your family here all year round? Not you, but I mean, we're...
No, nobody was.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very short season. Because there was, in my family, I forget the name of the town of Florida, so we went down there.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, I related mostly, I had a difficult kind of, I think it was difficult at the time, but I had a strange upbringing because for this season, my parents would leave Florida maybe early May, go to New York for a while, and then come to New Hampshire. Go to Montreal. My mother's family lived in Montreal. So in May we'd leave Florida, we'd be up here, and we'd stay all season. By the time we got back to Florida, it was October again.
Mm-hmm.
So I missed school all that time.
Yeah.
I never went to school the first or last market periods for
Yeah.
So that was weird, but since I guess I was being uprooted quite a bit, I was very friendly with the Whitcombs because there was a constant every
yeah.
summer.
Yeah, yeah, right.
And then in school relationships were already being built by the time I got back to Florida.
Yeah.
Awkward thing for me. So I really identified with the hotel workers.
Yeah.
And I liked the people that worked in the back of the house. I mean, in engineering and in the kitchen and that
the
sort
systems,
of thing.
The ones that were.
Yeah, the real work. And my aunt was the housekeeper at both hotels. And when I was very young, I used to hang around the linen room. And the maids used to be very nice to me and cuddle with me and things like that.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah. Generally. Yeah.
So that was. But these people that worked that went up and down the coast. Had nothing, no work between the summer season and the winter season, which was maybe Christmas to Easter. And there was no unemployment the way we have it today.
Mm-hmm.
And they used to they spend their time at the track? Could they be heavy drinkers? They'd be, they're these Runyon-esque types of characters. Thomas
Right.
Mm-hmm. And I always thought they were fascinating, and I still do. There's one guy who worked at the pool at the Vancouver. He was a fascinating guy. He had been a big-time college basketball player. And I guess one of these people has reached the pinnacle of fame at a very young age.
Yeah.
But he was an awfully nice guy, good-looking guy, and he used to always say, my goal this summer is to make enough money to go home and get money. Because he'd finish the season and pay off his debts from what he had borrowed before the season. Go home to broke, borrow money to get through, the, say, the fall, then work in Florida and make enough to pay off.
Yeah.
And that was the cycle of his life.
Yeah.
So as a result, many people went to the track. There was also a kind of a, there was a, probably a semi-criminal, quasi-criminal element. You know, he used to drink a lot of Drano and that kind of thing. Not Drano, I'm sorry, Sterno.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, aftershave lotion. I mean, people, there are some nutty people there, too.
That would be, give them like a druggy kind of flavor to things.
I guess you could say that.
Yeah. A Drano would do them in.
No, that wasn't Drano. It was Sterno.
So, you were here really your whole life, in terms of that was your schedule for the each year. How old do you remember when you were here? Was it like 4 or 3 or?
How young?
What's one of your earliest recollections being?
You know, I have
here?
A lot of pictures, so it's hard to decide whether it's a real recollection or whether it's from a picture that I'm reconstructing.
Mm-hmm.
But I had my birthday was in the middle of the summer, so I can remember some birthday parties and things like that.
Yeah.
My parents always had a big party because it wasn't so much for, there were kids there, but they also invited plenty of adults, and it was a kind of a social thing to have in the middle of the summer. Down at our house, we lived at a house called the Farm, Maplewood Farm. If you go to the the Franzim's house, just before the Franzim's, you turn left, there's a dirt road going back down.
Mm-hmm.
We lived in a house there.
Mm-hmm.
And at the time, the house is still fairly intact,
mm-hmm.
and it looks very nice, but when we were there, it had porches all around it,
mm-hmm.
a couple of very big barns, a lot of coaches, so buggies and coaches that were eventually voted into the museum. And so there had been a big, expansive lawn, so it was a nice place for a party.
Yeah.
People come down, it was nice to be, it's like almost like, I guess like sitting at the captain's table, you know, being invited to this nice party.
Yeah, right. Hmm. So how did you happen to run away?
My parents sent me to camp for a couple of summers, and I didn't like it.
Okay. Very different from being here. You weren't as free.
Maybe. I don't know. I really didn't enjoy camp. I just wasn't a camper. And the elder men in my family, my father and his two brothers, loved camp, so it seemed like a shame that everyone assumed that I would, and I didn't. But I wasn't asked. I was told. You know, nobody in those days, like the Maplewood, for instance, had a children's dining room. Children did not eat. They had a whole counselor system, and the kids were always taken care of, and they had wonderful activities. The school was there, and I could participate in those things if I wanted to. But I had other friends. I liked some of the Winthrop kids, and I was happy to hang out.
Yeah.
So, but as I said, it was another era, and I was expected to act a certain way and do certain things. We had to wear a tie at night in the hotel. And so my parents didn't ask me, and I just decided that I wasn't going to go. But I didn't especially raise hell or anything, because I knew that they were adamant. So I had a grandmother in Montreal, and I'd saved up $17. And I didn't know too much about Littleton. I was 10.
Mm-hmm.
I think I turned 10 then.
Mm-hmm.
I knew about Whitefield because I went there for allergy shots.
Mm-hmm.
So I had 17, and I knew the train to Montreal. At least I was under the impression the train went to Montreal from Whitefield. So I had $17, so I got up very early before anybody else would. And I decided I'd go to Whitefield and maybe find get on a train or something. And I walked through the woods next to the road because I didn't want anyone to see me.
Mm-hmm.
Everybody was out looking for me, so I was a little young kid and disappeared. So that night about dusk, and come to think it was in June, so it must have been fairly late, and I remember it was getting dark. Someone came up to me on the street in Whitefield and said, "What's your name, little boy?" or something like that.
Mm-hmm.
And I told him. The minute I told him my name, my heart sank. I said, "That was the stupidest thing ever, so why did I tell this guy my name?" And he did the typical thing like the Norman Rockwell painting. He took me to get an ice cream from the drugstore that was on the corner of, right on the square, there was a big drugstore. I think I mentioned the King Frank's clothing stores.
Uh-huh.
And so then he brought me back here. and our house was full of people. There were a lot of people there because obviously this whole day was, you know, I was supposed to go to camp that day, and it was, and the hotel was opening there the next day. And among the people there was Mr. Franzine, who was the trustee or whatever of the minister of the caddy camp. So the nice thing, the nice personal part of it for me was that my mother and Mr. Franzine seemed to have had a serious heart-to-heart talk that day. And Mr. Franzine explained, he had worked with children and had met all his life. And he explained to my mother that children actually had personalities of their own and needs of their own, and that it was important for parents to pay attention to those things. And so that was, it kind of paid off to run away. Because it had a good long-term effect, I would say, on my life, and certainly that of my younger brothers.
Are there two of you? Mr. Francine really did know kids.
It seemed like it. And he was always nice to me. I mean, I'd go over there sometimes. He would show me his wood shop, the secret doors in his house, and things like that. His wife was very nice to him.
So much fun to have that kind of background.
Yeah.
And those relationships that you never, ever forget.
Yeah, I'll never forget that, that's for sure. So, they were personal. The people that worked for the person. We had a maid, and my grandmother had a chauffeur, and they were often black, and they'd be the only black people, and that would be it. So that was sometimes, that, I think, and I was raised in Florida, where the schools were segregated, so it was total segregation, but everybody in my home and family, and a number of my teachers, I was talking to someone about this, because we were talking about how stupid study halls could be, especially profile, where I've done quite a bit of substitute teaching. I had some really courageous teachers that were anti-segregation, strongly that way, and so was my family. So it was, I was always aware of racial differences. But this is still a very homogeneous area.
Very much so.
It,
when you're in rural.
See it that much, I think. Probably the only people I see in the country. That's and you know, the spring and the fall, they have a convention up here. You can talk to a dozen caddies.
They'll stay at the Wayside Inn, I heard.
Oh, really?
Yeah. Do you have lifelong friends as a result of that? I mean, there's just other...
Well, it's, no, I might not see them that much, I think. Probably the only people I see at the convention in the summer.
Did the staying at the... And living and your folks being a part of the hotels here, did that influence your future?
That's a good question. I like the hotel business, so that might have some kind of work to do every now and then. You know, it is the business of all that I feel the most at home in, just naturally. It doesn't do that all anymore. I'm kind of in a related business now, but not running a hotel.
Right. If you were an audience, if you think of yourself as the audience and coming into, tell me that. Those are great questions.
Well, I only know one year. I know that there are many people that, after the war, made a few bucks, they started coming up here, and they had a good time. They stayed here. So until jet travel became feasible, and then it became more of a weekend thing, and people taking their whole summer vacations weren't coming up for anyone. They're going to Europe. So that those would be important to do it. More could afford it, and it also took a lot less time.
And who did come? Who were they? They were the wealthy?
They were middle-class people from Montreal and from Boston and from Rhode Island, I think mostly New York. I don't, you know, I was not that friendly with the guests personally, but I would say that generally those were the weather communities. There was a reservations office open all year long in New York. They took the reservations for both the Southland and Florida. And they advertised every Sunday in the New York Times. They had a great big ad.
There were trains.
Yeah, the trains in London was pretty good. You could take that train, you could fly to Berlin. And so there, you know, it wasn't that hard to get. Rather than most people drove, there were also a lot of cars. And there were people, a lot of the women in my family were here all summer, and the men would be driving to New York during.
Yeah, that's what we did when I went to East Hampton as a kid. My dad, we rented houses out at the East End, and Dad would go to work, and we'd be out there with Mom for the summer.
And my grandfather was kind of a colorful guy. He's the one that built businesses up so that they could enough to buy that hotel, and I think the main reason he left that hotel was to have his family around.
Yeah.
But every weekend he'd go to New York, and he said he always carried a pocket full of bills, money, because he would get, there was no interstate. He would constantly be stopped for speeding in all these different towns, and the policeman knew him. So he would just give him whatever it was at the time, $5 or $20, I don't know how much it cost, and he'd keep going. And that was his whole trip, back and forth, like having a toll every now and then. He'd have to just let. But he was always a speeder. He had boats. He used to, even with boats, he'd be in trouble with the Coast Guard for various infractions. He liked going fast. I think the dining room's at 400.
Mm-hmm.
It was a beautiful dining room, there's a picture with it, and the grounds were always full of beautiful flowers, and George Vanipelli can tell you that because he helped set out a lot of the flowers.
Okay.
And the walkways were full of snapdragons and petunias, and you name it, it was just redolent with aroma and color.
Right.
And there was a fellow named Phil Martinetti, whose name I'm sure will come up.
Yeah, I know that now.
Well, there's that block called the Martinetti Block.
Oh, yeah.
I think actually belonged to his brother. Mm-hmm. Phil lived in the house that now I think Don Ferengo lived in. But not in those days. I don't know where he lived. He used to live in the casino, as a matter of fact, when he worked at the hotel.
Mm-hmm.
He used to come up early in the season, and he would plant in greenhouses. There were a lot of greenhouses. He would plant the little seedlings and stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then people would set them out, and it was just magnificent.
Mm-hmm. Was Harry the...
Not in terms of scale, but in terms of appearance and the kind of elegance that he would give off. And really, at the time, at least, he was more elegant than Washington, which was very big. And I used to spend a lot of time with her because I had a very good friend that worked with her.
Mm-hmm.
I used to go stay at the dormitory.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But the Maplewood was, I mean, the food was a lot better. The golf was at the time better. You know, these things change over the years, but that's how it was during that period. So, sure, you would check in, you'd be there, listen, a bunch of people working. I don't know. Mainly golf, I think, was the biggest draw. There were a lot of golfers.
Do you think, this is just kind of,